This podcast is supported by the Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, one of America's leading medical research schools. How will advances in artificial intelligence transform medical research and medical care? To find out, we invite you to read a special supplement to Science Magazine prepared by Icon Mount Sinai in partnership with Science. Just visit our website at science.org and search for Frontiers of Medical Research-Artificial Intelligence. On May 1st and May 2nd, Icon Mount Sinai and the New York Academy of Sciences will be convening a major symposium in New York City on the new wave of AI in healthcare. For more information and to register, please visit events.nyas.org/AI Health. That's events.nyas.org/AI Health. The Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. We find a way. Before the show starts, I'd like to ask you to consider subscribing to News from Science. You've heard from some of our editors on here, David Grimm, Mike Price. They handle the latest scientific news with accuracy and good cheer, which is pretty amazing considering it can sometimes be over 20 articles a week. And you hear from our journalists. They're all over the world writing on every topic under the sun, and they come on here to share their stories. The money from subscriptions, which is about 50 cents a week, goes directly to supporting nonprofit science journalism, tracking science policy, our investigations, international news, and yes, when we find out new mummy secrets, we report on that too. Support nonprofit science journalism with your subscription at science.org/news. Scroll down and click subscribe on the right side. That's science.org/news. Click subscribe. This is the Science Podcast for May 12th, 2023. I'm Sarah Crespi. First up this week, innovations in organ donation technology lead to ethical debates. I talk with staff writer Jennifer Cousin-Frankel and surgeons and doctors and researchers about defining death technically. Next after that, what happens to abandoned lands as people leave the countryside for cities? Producer Kevin McLean talks with Gergana Desklova about how the end of human activities in certain places can lead to opportunities for biodiversity, but not always. In the U.S., there are typically 100,000 people waiting for organ transplants. These are people walking around and waiting. There are about only 14,000 deceased organ donors per year. Even if multiple organs are donated per death, kidneys, liver, heart, donation after death is not really meeting the annual need for transplants. This week in Science, staff writer Jennifer Cousin-Frankel wrote about a new technology that appears to increase the availability of donated organs, particularly hearts. But this technique has raised some ethical questions and has some asking for more data and more clarity on what exactly we mean by donation after death.
I wrote this story because I learned through some broader reporting on organ transplantation about a kind of organ donation that's actually been going on for a while in some countries, but that I wasn't familiar with. And it struck me as just fascinating medically, ethically, in so many ways. And in the U.S., it's saving lives right now and is also the subject of a lot of debate.
The debate, in a nutshell, a person is in a terrible, unrecoverable state. Their family decides to withdraw life-supporting treatment and also participate in organ donation. That person is taken off of life support. They wait for the heart to stop. Then you wait 5 more minutes and declare them dead. Then you use machines to restart circulation and sometimes the heart, and then you procure their organs. Is that okay? That's a debate. Let's get into the nuance. We'll start with what exactly it means to become an organ donor after death. I was able to talk to a few of the experts that Jennifer used as sources for her story, transplant surgeons, an ICU doctor and researcher interested in further exploring the implications of these different kinds of donations, and a bioethicist who herself is also a transplant specialist. And what they all told me is that in the U.S. and some other countries, there's something called the dead donor rule. Nader Mozami, a heart transplant surgeon at NYU's Langone Health, actually, he did the first of these controversial donor heart transplants here in the U.S. He describes the dead donor rule like this.
Death donor rule is a series of ethical principles that was put together by Robertson in the 1960s. These ethical principles basically state two things. One is that the process of organ donation should not cause the death of the individual. That's one of the fundamental clauses, right? Organ donation should not cause the death of an individual, and organs cannot be removed from live patients. Those ethical principles were framed because, unfortunately, some physicians had done these things in the 1960s.
So that's the dead donor rule. Another transplant surgeon I spoke with, Angie Wall, she's an abdominal transplant surgeon and bioethicist at Baylor University Medical Center in Texas. She explained the difference between two types of donations that can happen after the death of a donor.
There are basically two different ways that somebody can become a deceased donor in the United States. They can either be a donor through brain death, which is where they are declared dead by neurologic criteria. And what that means is they have no function of the entire brain or the brainstem. And when that happens, they are still functionally on machines, the heart is beating, they're on a ventilator, but the organs are functioning within the body of that donor other than the brain. Those are the donors in which all of the organs can be procured, the heart, the lungs, the liver, the kidneys, the pancreas, small bowel, et cetera, because everything has blood going through it until the point of taking the organs out of the body.
To recap, that was a description of the neurological determination of death before donation, or donation after brain death. The other type we're going to hear about is called donation after circulatory death.
And in that procedure, what happens is that there has been a decision to withdraw any life-sustaining treatments on that individual who has suffered usually a devastating brain injury, but does not meet the definition of neurologic or brain death. So in those individuals, the process of organ donation starts with the withdrawal of life-sustaining treatment. And in those individuals, death is declared by cardiopulmonary criteria. And what that means is there's no longer any respiratory function and the heart stops beating. And then once those criteria are met, an independent physician declares that the individual is dead. We have a hands-off period where we confirm that there is no auto-resuscitation, meaning they don't start breathing again on their own, the heart doesn't start on its own. And then if there's no auto-resuscitation, we begin the organ procurement. The procurement procedure begins within about 5 minutes of the declaration of death.
This 5-minute period, they call it the standoff period. Life support has been withdrawn. The patient is allowed to progress naturally to death. Their heart stops. 5 minutes happens. They're declared dead. And after that, the organ donation procedures take over. This 5-minute period, they call it the standoff period. Life support has been withdrawn. The patient is allowed to progress naturally to death. Their heart stops. 5 minutes happens. They're declared dead. And after that, the organ donation procedures take over. This is different from donation after neurological death. In that case, all the same blood flow, everything that was done to support the patient, stays in place until the second the donation process begins. In donation after circulatory death, there's this 5-minute standoff, and then the rush begins.
In that rapid recovery process, you have to very quickly put cannulas into the blood vessels, flush them with preservation solution, and cool them down in order for them to be usable for transplantation.
So everything is done in a rush. This is 5 minutes, 10 minutes, as fast as they possibly can. Everything is put on ice. And as Jennifer says, there are some challenges to doing this.
What doctors learned is that they could recover certain organs from them, the liver, the kidneys, the lungs, And those organs did pretty well when you just kind of put them on ice and transplanted them. This didn't work so well for the heart, or there have been concerns it wouldn't work so well for the heart, because the heart is kind of more susceptible to that time when there was no circulation as that person died.
You really don't want to transplant a heart that isn't likely to work in the recipient.
You couldn't really use that method to transplant the heart. One strategy that's been used is to put the heart on an external machine that stimulates electric activity, makes it beat, runs oxygenated blood through it.
So one way to get a usable heart after circulatory death is declared. You have to wait for the heart to stop. You have to wait those 5 minutes. And then you get the heart onto a machine as soon as possible. But Jennifer says that while this is being done, the approach has limitations. So in the United Kingdom, they tried something different for the heart.
Then there's this other category that was first tried by doctors in the UK, where the individual went through that same process of death. They waited 5 minutes. They declared that individual to have died. Then what they did was they restarted circulation inside that individual's body, generally to the organs that they wanted to transplant. And if you're talking about the heart in that situation, that means restarting a heartbeat. And the other thing that they did, actually before restarting circulation, is they clamp off vessels that lead to the brain. And this is to prevent any blood from reaching the brain in that individual.
What we're talking about here is what is known as normothermic regional perfusion, basically restarting blood flow to only a certain part of the body so that the organs don't have to be removed immediately. It basically gets you to the same point as if you had a donor after brain death instead of a donor after circulatory death. And as Jennifer said, in some cases, the heart itself restarts. And this is where the ethical debates come in. Angie Wall, the transplant surgeon at Baylor University Medical Center in Texas, who we heard from earlier describing the different types of donation after death, is also a bioethicist. And she says that a lot of the debate here has to do with how we define death.
If you think about it, these donors have just been declared dead by cardiopulmonary criteria. They are not breathing and their heart has stopped. If you then restart the heart either on a machine or inside of the donor's body, have you reversed this underlying determination of death? Or are you showing that this person wasn't really dead by cardiopulmonary criteria?
You get really right into the thick of the definition of death. If you're declaring death based on these criteria, then you change the state of those particular variables that you were looking at.
I think it's more you change the status of the individual organs in that person who has been declared dead. You don't change the underlying reason that there was a decision to withhold or withdraw life-sustaining treatment. And you don't change the underlying process that led to their death, which is there is no longer an integrated function of that individual. They are unable to breathe on their own, and their heart stops because their body is no longer functioning as a coordinated effort toward maintaining their organ function.
So in addition to circulating oxygenated blood, which can restart the heart and helps the organs in the heart itself be eligible for transplant for longer periods of time, before any of that even happens, the major vessels that go to the brain are clamped off. This is another area of ethical contention. Nader Mozami, who's done these type of donor heart transplants, he's done it in multiple patients, describes why some people question this clamping process.
They're saying, well, if you're saying that the patient is dead, right, so why are you ligating the vessels to the head? Because they're dead. That shows that you are not, the patient is not dead. And my response to that always has been, listen, you know, we are physicians. The humane thing to do is first do no harm. We have to ensure that once circulation is restored by this machine, there is no blood flow to the brain. Because the brain at the end of the day is still a black box. And since we don't know what is going on with the brain, it is completely and fully our duty to ensure that there is no flow to the brain and that there is no restoration of awareness.
So this is an open question. We do not know if circulating blood to the brain after death could turn on awareness or turn on the sensation of pain. One of the people I spoke with, Murat Slazarov, he's a ICU intensivist, a physician, a researcher at the London Health Sciences Center in Ontario, Canada. He actually studies what happens to the brain after life support is withdrawn. At this time, Canada does not allow hearts that have been through this perfusion process to be donated, but the technology is being studied.
Now, the key issue here is the surgeons will apply clamps to prevent the blood flow circulating back to the brain. The reason for that is we want to recondition organs intended for transplantation prior to them being transplanted. We're essentially trying to reverse the injury that these organs have sustained during the dying process. But what we don't want to do is to reanimate the brain, right? Because the donor explicitly stated that they wanted to die and they didn't want to be brought back alive. And death in this context is permanent stopping of brain function. This is how we define it in Canada now. So we want to avoid circulation of oxygenated blood back to the brain.
So there are a couple of good reasons that we don't want blood to circulate to the brain after death has been declared. But, you know, I really feel like we keep circling this definition of death, Jennifer. We're literally at, what is death? How long does it take?
We're used to someone saying, you know, doctor saying very authoritatively, time of death, 5:40 a.m. And again, this is totally unrelated to organ donation. It happens all the time, of course.
Yeah.
We've all seen it in medical dramas.
Let's say ER, my favorite medical drama.
We've all seen this. And it happens all the time. And that's because I think in medicine, medically, legally, ethically, we need a time of death. We can't just be all squishy about it. But death is a process, as this doctor said to me, not a time point. You know, if we're thinking just biologically, the cells in your body can take several hours to die. We have now sophisticated machinery that can induce a heartbeat or other, you know, activity in your organs hours after you've died. So what does that mean? Where is the line between life and death? I think it gets very philosophical and very difficult in some ways.
Murat Slazarov, the ICU intensivist based in London, Canada, has taken a really close look at what happens to the brain after the withdrawal of life support.
We did a pilot study that enrolled 8 patients here in London who were undergoing withdrawal of life-sustaining measures. And we monitored their brain activity and brain blood flow during this dying process. And we also monitored their arterial line. And so what we found in that study is that brain activity stops approximately 78 seconds before the heart stops. Now, we also have brain blood flow data. We just haven't analyzed it yet. It's in the process, but a preliminary look at the data suggests that it stops before, even earlier. So it says brain blood flow stops, then brain activity, then circulatory rest.
Just to go over that again, Murat and his team monitored what happened after the withdrawal of life support. And they found the first thing was that brain activity stops. And then the heart stopped.
We're now doing a multi-center study in Canada. And the reason we needed to do a multi-center study, we want to enroll 90 patients in total, is because patterns of withdrawal of life-sustaining therapies differ between different hospitals and different regions of the country.
What this does is get at the question, can you use circulatory death as a proxy for brain death? Can declaring death with cardiopulmonary criteria tell you that this person no longer has brain activity at the time?
We assumed that the brain has stopped at the time of circulatory arrest. But some people would say, well, how do you know? Well, this is the answer to that, right?
So I asked Jennifer, you know, how much does this process improve people's chances of getting organs if these kinds of recoveries continue to expand?
Well, the estimate I've heard from heart transplant surgeons is that this kind of donation could increase the supply of hearts by about 30%. And I heard that's roughly that same number for the UK as well as the US. It's potentially particularly useful for hearts. These circulatory donations for transplants are actually very common, especially for certain organs. It's this inside the body circulation piece that's less common and is the subject of my story. The interest in these transplants is definitely driven by the fact that we, you know, as you say, there's a scarcity of organs. We need more organs. There are people waiting and dying, waiting.
Nader Mozami, the heart transplant surgeon based in New York, sees this every day.
You don't understand what it means to be sitting in a hospital waiting for a heart every day. It's an incredible, incredible burden on these patients because they are always fearful that they're going to die before an organ becomes available. But at the same time, you know, I've seen them like struggle with this concept that someone has to die for me to be able to live. You know, I always try to calm them or try to tell them that, listen, if somebody dies, it's not your fault. You have no control of it. I have no control of it. But at least out of their generosity, that is out of a family's selfless generosity, you and many other people will be recipients of that gift.
But I also think it's driven somewhat by families who really feel in some cases that it's very important to them to donate their loved one's organs. And the heart in particular, I think, can have extra meaning for a family. I've heard of cases where the donor family meets the recipient and actually is listening to their loved one's heart in the recipient. And that's just really, I think, really powerful and meaningful for them.
So Jennifer, were you surprised by this? I don't know why, but I was a little surprised how much of the donation process is driven by the donor or the donor's family.
Yeah, and that's something that really struck me in this story. I spoke to a couple of donor families who lost teenage or young adult children and made the decision to donate their organs. They talked about really how meaningful this has been to them and how it's helped their healing over the years and everything they've had to navigate with losing their child. Knowing that their child, as one family put it to me, you know, kind of became a hero by donating her organs was very, I think, impactful for them.
Having to wait some undetermined amount of time after life support is withdrawn, waiting for the heart to stop, and then the 5 minutes, and then the declaration of death. This time period, waiting for a loved one to be declared dead in order for them to donate organs, is a very difficult thing for a family. Because sometimes it takes too long and the organs can't be used. Angie Wall, the transplant surgeon based in Texas, says that this is an incredibly complicated decision, particularly when it comes to donation after a circulatory death.
It changes where the withdrawal of life-sustaining treatment occurs most of the time. It changes the timing of the withdrawal of life-sustaining treatment. You have to wait until you have some workup of the potential organ donor, you have some imaging, and that the organs are placed with transplant centers. So sometimes it can take days before procurement can occur. And so the family invests a lot of time and energy and trust in organ donation, and they want it to happen. They would not say yes if they did not want something good to come out of the death of their loved one. And so if we are within the ethical boundaries of not harming the potential donor, if we don't do everything that we can to make organ donation happen, then I think we are doing a disservice to families.
We're going to have to keep thinking about these problems, these definitions. As Murat, the researcher studying this in Canada, says, there's going to be change when it comes to transplant technology in the future.
I think the meta learning from this whole exercise for me personally has been, look, you know, organ donation and transplantation is an innovation-rich environment. New innovations will come along the way all the time. However, it's also built on public and stakeholder trust. And so our role is to support innovation, because that's what saves lives and allows our donors to leave a legacy and fulfill their wishes to be donors, but also do so in a careful, transparent, thoughtful manner that preserves the trust in organ donation.
Before we wrap up, Jennifer, do you want to talk a little bit about why this has been a difficult story to write?
I think there's a lot of emotion here, as you can imagine. You know, I spoke with one person who received a triple organ transplant via this method, and he may well not have survived if he had not gotten this transplant. And then I spoke with donor families whose loved ones had died by brain death, not by this method. And they talked about the importance of the donation for them. But I also think we have to remember that there are people who are not comfortable with this. There are arguments, too, that even if families want this, there are still questions about the ethics. Is it enough to say families are consenting to this and want this donation, or do we need more before making these really widespread in medicine?
That was Jennifer Cousin Frankel, a staff writer here at Science. You can find a link to the feature story we discussed at science.org/podcast. Stay tuned for a chat with producer Kevin McLean and researcher Gergana Daskalova on the complex interactions that lead to land abandonment and how this impacts on diversity and conservation. This week's episode is brought to you in part by Science Careers. Change your job and you might just change the world. For anyone who's looking to get ahead in or just plain get into science, there's no better, more trusted resource than Science Careers. And it's free. On our site, you can search career opportunities across all disciplines and levels, research potential employers, sign up to get job alerts via email, upload your resume or CV to the searchable database, or read career advice articles. There's no shortage of global problems today that science can't solve. Be part of the solution. Visit sciencecareers.org today.
As people flock to cities, rural populations decline, and the land they leave behind is abandoned. It's a pattern we're seeing to varying degrees all over the world, and the fate of these abandoned lands depends on a lot of different factors. This week in Science, Gergana Daskalova and her colleague Johannes Kamp discuss the many drivers and implications of land abandonment, and the place of these lands in conservation and biodiversity goals. Gergana, welcome to the Science Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Great. So first, let's maybe just get some definitions going here. So what exactly are you talking about when you discuss land abandonment?
Land abandonment takes many shapes. And in fact, that's one of the very things that we want to highlight. For example, you might have relatives that used to live in the rural side, and you know, their sons, their daughters, they moved to the cities, and not everybody wants to farm the land. So then you have land that's no longer cultivated by people. So one type of land abandonment would be, for example, a field that's no longer managed for at least 5 years. So usually you're looking at some longer term abandonment. But abandonment is not just about crops. It can also be about forestry. So for example, forests that are not getting cut down, and it can be entire villages. For example, the village that I'm coming to you from right now used to have 1,200 people living here around 70 years ago. And now I'm one of 200.
Oh, wow.
So that's a decline of over 1,000 people in a very short period of time.
Yeah.
That means that there's also abandoned houses, abandoned roads, a lot of abandoned human infrastructure. So abandonment essentially is the end of human activity, whatever that might be.
Mm-hmm. And you talk in the perspective a lot about so much land that has been abandoned since the 1950s. Why has that been happening, and what's sort of driving all of this?
So there are many reasons for abandonment, but there's been some historic ones that have created really big spikes of abandonment. The first of those would be the First and Second World War. So in general, really big wars mean that there are less people there to manage the land. It can be political events that essentially spur these waves of abandonment. And then there can be social factors and changes in economy. So one of the biggest increases in abandonment happened after the crash of the Soviet Union. And then there's also other drivers like soil degradation. if it's no longer profitable to grow food or crops at a given location. If nothing's growing that's of interest to people, then that land will get abandoned and some land elsewhere could get cultivated. Sometimes abandonment in one place is actually like the expense of cultivation somewhere else.
Okay, so there are these broad causes, conflicts, world war, and then more local or individual causes, people deciding to leave rural areas to seek opportunities elsewhere, or just, you know, the cost of farming on a small scale increasing, that leaves agricultural fields, forests, homes, and other types of land abandoned. How do you think about all these different kinds of abandonment from an ecological perspective?
I come into land abandonment as a scientist, but also as a person who has lived through it and seen it happen all throughout my life. And so I think for me, first, like growing up, I saw what's happening around my own village. I could see, for example, here where I live in Bulgaria, the soil is relatively fertile. And there's decent amounts of rain. That means that the trees start growing very fast. So if a garden is not managed for 5 years, when you try to go through it on year six, it would actually be really challenging to make your way through the brambles and the tree saplings and the shrubs that are growing. But then I became a scientist and I left my village, and I have since done research all over the world and have looked at abandonment from a different perspective, from the perspective of now an ecologist. That has allowed me to, yeah, in a way, give myself some more explanations. So the type of soil, the type of climate, and also how intensively the land was used before, all of that can shape distinct biodiversity trajectories. And often it's about the ecological contrast that's getting created. So if you imagine monocultures, fields that as far as you can see, like they stretch into the horizon and it's the same thing. As those fields get abandoned, for example, the soil is too eroded and there isn't really like any profit to farm them. What happens on those fields can really vary from place to place. In Australia, it's actually quite challenging for native seeds to germinate on such land, on land that has been farmed really intensively. So in Australia, you could actually see abandoned fields that just stay empty or they become invaded by foreign weeds. But if you imagine a field in Eastern Europe, particularly one in the mountains, there you could see forests establishing much more quickly. And that would mean that forest species become favored. It's really this like game of winners and losers, when not just in life, but also when it comes to biodiversity. And if a village or a rural region gets abandoned, then instead of the whole rainbow of colors and the whole mix of habitats, you might just get one dominating habitat. And then only the species that like that habitat will be the ones that increase in abundance.
Right. Right. So it's not just the species that happen to be there when it is abandoned. It's the competitive interactions and everything that take over after it's been abandoned.
Yeah.
I thought it was really interesting that you sort of called back the role of abandoned fields, like and how they played a role in kind of our foundational knowledge of ecology, particularly in terms of succession. I mean, can you talk a little, there is actually like quite a history of like getting a lot of information about what we know about how the world works from abandoned lands. Can you talk a little bit about that and maybe about sort of where you see these types of lands directing our understanding moving forward?
When I first started my ecology education, one of the key theories that we got taught is the theory of ecological succession, which is all about how an ecosystem would change over time. And I have a book that is way too thick to even be a single book, but yet it is a single book. And that book starts with a paper about what at the time were called old fields. In that case, it was old fields in the US. They were the inspiration behind succession, and ecologists tracked how a field that was farmed 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago how that looks now. And so you can see how the vegetation goes from first it's like grassier, then you see more shrubs appearing, and then the shrubs outcompete the grasses, then there's some broadleaf forests, and eventually the idea was that it would be a coniferous forest and it would stay like this. Of course, everything's controversial in ecology and it always depends what that final outcome is.
Everything depends.
Yeah. So it is a contested theory, but it's still one of the key theories in ecology. And it stimulated so much research and so much of what we have found out about the natural world has in a way been inspired by those first few bits of knowledge that we got from abandoned fields.
Well, one of the things I was sort of curious about is what motivated you to write this perspective now? Like, why is this such an important issue to consider right now?
I personally have always seen land abandonment as this really significant driver of biodiversity change, but also this hidden driver. It's something that happens out of sight, and what's out of sight is usually out of mind. And I have the personal background that for me, land abandonment and human depopulation is not a surprise, but that's not the case for everyone. And that's not the case for also policymakers and country leaders and the people who, you know, help shape what our planet is like. And we are at this stage in biodiversity science, in biodiversity policy, where we need to find solutions that work for both people and nature.
Yeah.
And abandoned land, it's rarely considered when we try to figure out how do we protect biodiversity and how do we ensure that also people's livelihoods are maintained. My motivation for this perspective very much comes from the combination of my scientific expertise and also like my personal life. And I think it's really important for all of us to realize that humans are changing the planet not just by building bigger and bigger cities, but also by abandoning the places where they used to be before. And perhaps there's this opportunity to find the best way to use this abandoned land. And now we have to work collaboratively to find what that way is.
Right. Right. Yeah, I know there's sometimes a sense that just letting nature be will fix things. And, you know, it sounds like it's a lot more complicated than that, actually. Like leaving things without any intervention can have particular implications that could be good or bad or just, you know, different for the system, right?
Good and bad is very relative to who you're asking. And
right.
And I think one of the key things that we want to bring forward with our perspective is that we need to look at it from not just the ecology side or not just from the human side, but try to combine both of those as good as possible. Because sometimes when land gets abandoned or an entire village gets abandoned, you do see this like exciting wildlife return. Wolves are a classic success story in certain parts of Europe, for example. Some people might look at that landscape and see that the wolves have returned and find a lot of joy in that. And that's obviously a conservation success. But other people might look at the same landscape and see the lost traditions, the lost culture. Yeah, so it can actually be a very painful experience for people that has a lot of sorrow involved in it. So it's not just about the nature or just about the people. It's about trying to find a way to manage the land that achieves the best balance between the two.
Yeah, yeah. You talk pretty specifically in the perspective about sort of incorporating human connections to nature. And, you know, the scale of abandonment worldwide is pretty enormous. And it sounds like the effects of what could happen to these ecosystems, you know, depends on a lot of different factors. But what should be done, I guess, at this point? I think you talked a little bit about management and just, you know, incorporating it into planning. Is that the stage that you're at in terms of thinking about this?
So there are several key steps forward when it comes to land abandonment and also rural depopulation. Still, a big unknown is that we don't know exactly the scale. We know that there's a lot of it, and we're much better at estimating cropland abandonment But other types of abandonment, like grassland abandonment or forestry abandonment, there are many unknowns that remain there. Then the next key step, and that's what my own research focuses at the moment, is combining the information we have about abandonment and depopulation with biodiversity data and tracking biodiversity over time at these abandoned places and seeing essentially why in some places we see a gain in biodiversity and in others we see losses. What are the species that benefit and for which species is the abandonment a threat? And it might be that indeed in certain places we can just let nature be and that delivers positive outcomes. But it might be that there are regions where we need to intervene, where we might need some incentives for a certain way of farming or incentives to support local livelihoods and more traditional style living. And currently, we have very little information about where we need to do what. Another reason why it's important to look at abandoned land now is the cusp of new international policy drafted for biodiversity and ecosystems around the world. We are deciding what actions countries all over the world need to take. So, for example, with the new goals that are part of the Convention on Biological Diversity. So far, land abandonment has rarely featured in these discussions. So my hope is that with this perspective, we can shine the spotlight on abandoned land and we can bring it back into the conversation and see perhaps these lands have more to give.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Gergana. This has been really, really interesting.
Thank you very much as well for helping us put the spotlight on the places where people have left.
Yeah, absolutely. Gergana Daskalova is a Schmidt Science Fellow in the Biodiversity, Ecology, and Conservation Group at the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis. You can find a link to the perspective we discussed at science.org/podcasts.
And that concludes this edition of the Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions, write to us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. You can listen to the show on our website, science.org/podcast, or search for Science Magazine on any podcasting app. This show was edited by me, Sarah Crespi, and Kevin McLean, with special thanks to Megan Cantwell for her help with the organ transplant segment, and especially Jennifer Cousin-Frankel. We also had production help from Podigy. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. On behalf of Science and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.